As we struggle every day with the computers, we begin to feel the immediate need for a little Zen philosophy or something of that nature to keep us in one piece. And I think that the most interesting ancient approach to the whole problem of modern intellectualism is that of Buddhism, which in turn derived most of its fundamentals from Hinduism. In the Hindu classics, there is the simple line, "The mind is the slayer of the real." And through thousands of years of human experience, this has been more or less proven to be true. The mind is something that we do not understand, for there is no way apparently that we can grasp its proportions except by its own use. And it is a little bit like a dictator who gradually takes on control and command of every part of man's instruments of knowledge and growth. The mind must be considered, therefore, as a kind of machine. And Buddha called it the machine of the six sensory perceptions. Now, at his time, machinery must have been pretty primitive, but he still used this term, and he used it in a way that was quite authoritative. He meant definitely that the mind was an instrument. The mind is not the self. The mind does not speak for the self. The mind does not make infallible utterances. The mind is bound to a series of mechanical processes rather parallel to those of a computer. The mind has to take in certain information. This information is then classified and organized, and certain conclusions arise as to the relative values of the various fragments of understanding or experience or evidence that we find. There is no point, apparently, in the mental instrument in which it can transcend itself. Now, it is certainly true that if you buy a cheap computer, you're not going to get much. And if you live through life with a cheap mind, you're not going to do much better. Fortunately, however, we can gain certain mental maturities. We can become a little more wise in thinking. We can discipline the machine. Just as the operator of a computer has to know what he's doing, has to study the problems of his instrument, or else get into serious difficulties, so the same is true of the mind. We take it for granted, but it is not something that can safely be taken for granted. The mind is an instrument that has to be observed, that has to be worked with, that has to be enlightened as far as possible, and must be always under the discipline of something superior to itself. There must be the operator, not only for the computer, but for the mind. And this is part of the oldest form of Indian philosophy, that there has to be something above the phenomenal existence to help us to create a way of life that can escape from mediocrity. That we do not need to go on through life learning little, suffering much, and actually passing out of this environment very little ahead of what we were when we came in. Experience is important, but only if we understand it. All kinds of living gives us information, if we know how to gather that information. We read books. Maybe they help, but without discrimination, reading can be a total loss. We go and travel to different parts of the world, and through the sensory perceptions, we observe where we've been. But we can go completely around the world and come home without any basic understanding of humanity. All these problems go back to the machine of the sensory perceptions. And the principal perceptions, according to Buddhism, are five. what we call the five senses. And these are the gateways by means of which information goes in to the computer. These five channels, therefore, are constantly affecting each other and together affecting the conduct of the person to whom they belong. We can see all kinds of things, but if we do not see value, then all is lost. We can have all opportunities for education, but if we simply decline to be educated, we can graduate with honors and still be ignorant. Because these values are either temporary, superficial, or earnest. And if these values are earnest, everything contributes to life. Now in Zen, all the testimonies of the sensory perceptions are simply filtered through a series of disciplines to come out with the final conclusion that the thing as it is right. Now, the thing as it is may not be at all appealing to us, and we may spend our lives trying to avoid it or evade it. But the entire purpose of life is to discover the meaning of life, to find in all the evidence that pours in the gradual accumulation of a constructive integration of faculties. In other words, we must come to the point where we begin to understand the real values of daily experience. We must also come to the point where we can accept and work with our own shortcomings, that we can discover what parts of our nature are undeveloped and therefore open to tragedy. We can do many, many things if we use the computer intelligently. But we have to realize that no matter how we use it, it deals with the external life of the person. The computer is the same thing as any other physical instrument. It has limitations. The telescope can look far out into space and give considerable information to the skilled astronomer, but the instrument itself can never understand that which it discovers. Something has to use it that is superior to itself. The one who uses a computer must be superior to the instrument in order to control and direct it. And the individual who has a mind must be superior to the intellect if he expects to have a constructive life. He cannot follow the mind. He must lead it. And the way to lead it, of course, has always been one of the great mysteries of life. Up to the present time, the only answer we have to the problem of leadership is that there is something superior to mind. Some have called it soul power. Others have called it spirit. Some have regarded it as a differentiation of deity. But there has to be something above the mind, or it will become a dictator. And as a dictator will spend the life of the individual fulfilling the mind's desires and trying to prove that the mind's desires are inevitable to the happiness of the person. As against this point of view, we realize that most people with good minds are in trouble. They are worried, they are frightened. In fact, they have many kinds of anxieties that comparatively undeveloped minds have not yet caught up to. In other words, if you are a simple person and have had practically no complication in living, you have certain direct, simple values. You have a clear concept of right and wrong. But the mental coordinator will mix that concept so completely that you will end by simply doing what you felt like doing in the first place. There is no discipline in the mind. In fact, it leads us constantly into temptation. To use the mental coordinator, therefore, we have to recognize that a very large part of man's internal life is under the control of his external circumstances. While he lives in this world, in this material and physical plane of existence, material things become increasingly important to him. And this importance is reflected through the testimonies of the sensory perceptions. He finds that he enjoys wealth. He likes to have a palatial home. He wishes to outreach his neighbors in elegance and perhaps in temperance. These things are all mental attitudes, but they come back into the mind and reassert themselves, gradually tearing down the entire moral structure until nothing is important except wealth. And that is the condition that many people are in today, and the large part of the world is suffering from. The mental coordinator of humanity in general, the level of the might be termed average individual, is largely dominated by physical considerations. That which is beyond the physical is beyond interest or beyond activity in our daily living. So on the basis of the physical, we take in all kinds of evidence. We take in all kinds of experiences. We find who our friends and our rivals are. We see what makes us sick and what helps to keep us well. All kinds of testimonies come in through these five sensory perceptions. Actually, if we used a little bit of thoughtfulness, we could gain experience from all of these things that happen to us. But largely, the mental coordinator interprets these things according to its own structure and pressure. Therefore, instead of a certain incident impelling us to recognize a personal defect, the mind will assist us to blame this incident on somebody else. The mind is forever protecting its own attitudes and interests because it has nothing else that it can do. Consequently, we cannot depend upon it transcending its own level. We have to work with it on the level in which it exists. Now, taking the problem of daily living, we realize that the five sensory perceptions are like five doorways or channels by which information from the outside goes into the mind, into the inner life of the person. These windows, therefore, are very important to us, and they must be kept clean. If the window glasses become overshadowed with dirt or soot, they can no longer bring us the proper viewpoint or give us the proper knowledge. And most of this obscuring factor that distorts or obscures the glass will be prejudice and excessive opinionism and excessive egoism. These things will cause the experience to be worthless before it even reaches the mind. It will be rejected totally by the person who says to himself, "I have no defects. I'm here and I'm doing all I want to do and I'm a success." Therefore, when danger signals show up, this person rejects them. And even if they get through into the mind, the mental process itself must work with them. Now, when the mind starts operating on these problems, these five streams all flow in at once. Usually one or two are dominant at a time. But the thing seen is also perhaps the thing heard. The thing looked at may be the food that is tasted. All kinds of testimonies come from the sensory perceptions. And those, of course, most commonly used are sight and hearing. These become the basis of what we would call truth. Truth is what we see, for the thing seen must be real. Truth is the thing we hear. And because we hear it, and because it is pronounced by some exalted authority, we decide it must be true. Therefore, from the outside, hearing and seeing are the two greatest factors and the greatest thieves and robbers in the sensory gamut. In the first place, things seen, as such, have little or no meaning. It is the meaning of the thing seen. It is the interpretation of the symbol, which is the thing we see, and which must remind us that the truths of life, the values of life, and the very substance of life itself will always be invisible. Therefore, we can only see what it does. And the moment we see what it does, we begin to interpret it. And by the time we've interpreted it, we've taken the natural truth that it might have revealed entirely out of it. So the problem is to see straight, to see clearly, and to see honorably. These things require the development of a faculty of honesty in ourselves. We have to be willing to accept the unpleasant if it is true. We must be willing to blame ourselves if we are guilty. And we also have to be in a position to realize that a large percentage of our difficulties in life arise from our own conduct. If we can come this far, we will begin to influence the mental coordinator. For this mental coordinator also carries within it the function of memory. And the memory bank is one of the features of a computer. And memory, therefore, can revive at any time, at will, most of the important incidents of a person's life. And these incidents may have been passed over without any consideration of value when they occurred. But memory can bring them back as symbols which a more mature degree of our intellect can help to interpret. Therefore, out of the things that have happened in the past, much useful information can be gained if we overcome this sense of infallibility in which we cannot conceive of ourselves making mistakes. Now, we know we do, but we pass over it lightly. We do not wish to become entangled in the concept of judging ourselves when we are wrong. Now, into this computer, therefore, that we have here, the mind, we have these streams of evidence. Some of them are like the films in a motion picture theater. Some of them are highly symbolical. Some of them are trash. Many of them can be used in an important way. Others are just not for us. But these all have to be sifted out and combined with others, evidences, to bring a total picture from the mind of all of the aspects of a particular problem. If we are considering an apple, we must consider what it looks like. We must consider what it tastes like, the color, the texture, the aroma. We must consider all these things to get a full definition of what an apple looks like. Now, this process is instantaneous in the mind, but it is only there because faculties have brought in the evidence. If the evidence is contrary, then the judgment is wrong. If it should happen that the testimony did not notice that there was a worm in the apple, then the coordinator takes it on. It comes out with a verdict that is unrealistic. Therefore, everything has to depend upon the acceptance of the experiences of life. A constant receptivity to the wonder of fact and truth, which are by far the most important values that we can cultivate. Now, as the information all goes into this memory bank situation, it can form a basis for dispositional decisions. The individual no longer thinks simply from the occasions of the moment. He doesn't like or dislike only on the occasions of the instant. He calls upon the record in this bank. He can bring back all the indications and recordings of what has ever happened to him. He can find definitely ways to perpetuate a grudge forever. He can also find the consequences of perpetuating it for a number of years and realize that it did no good. Therefore, out of the memory bank, we get symbols from the past that help us to integrate the present and build for the future. Life is one unbroken sequence, and when we begin to break it so completely into past, present, and future, we lose the value of the memory bank of the testimonies of things done and the substances of things hoped for. Therefore, the mind has to work together in all its faculties and parts. Now, one of the things that Zen is concerned with is the problem of detaching the mind itself from the tremendous attachments that it has to phenomenal things, which are, at best, impermanent. Zen would like to believe that the individual, through discipline, can restore the essential common sense which was his in the beginning, that he will no longer fall victim to a series of false beliefs or doctrines. The fact that he reads a certain book and finds in it an opinion that seems to satisfy him at the moment is no proof that this opinion is true. The Zen attitude is, in a sense, almost brutal in the fact that it has no place in it whatever for human self-deceit. The individual either faces reality or admits that he can't face them. So out of this facing of reality comes a simplification of life. A number of the Greek philosophers, including Diogenes and Socrates, were also exponents of the simple life. That the way to escape from problems is to have no ulterior motive in yourself when you contemplate the conduct of others. If you have a firm foundation of integrities, you will find integrity in everything that you see, whether you like it or not. The integrity may be a warning, it may be a reward, it may be a penalty, but it will be honorable, honest, and inevitable. As soon as we begin to see some of these things, we stop fighting with ourselves, we stop blaming life for our misfortunes, we stop hating other people, and we begin to relax away from the most powerful of all physical factors, possession. The Zen man is not likely to be overly interested in possession. Nearly all of the sages of the East and most of the monks of the West have been sworn to poverty. They do not want things because they know that things are among the most powerful forces to destroy character. That whatever the individual has, he must learn to use or he will abuse. Now, to transform an abuse to a use is a matter of understanding. It's a matter of calling upon the resources, not only of the mind, but of the heart, to find out what was wrong and how it can be corrected. Actually, also, in worldly things, the Mahayana school of Buddhism did not advocate a monastic life for everybody. The only individual who should take on a monastic life in Buddhist philosophy is the individual who doesn't need it. When he can get along perfectly well in this world, adjust himself nicely and easily to the problems of daily existence, has learned many good and useful lessons, and has brought his own conduct under the control of integrity, this individual is ready for a monastic life. But any individual who uses it to run away from trouble is just fooling himself. Because this is the result of a dominant, aggressive mental interference with the proper course of life. So the simple life is one in which the individual does not experience a sense of loss. He has decided by his own experience that the things that he gathers are his losses. The things that he lets go of are his gains. This is something that philosophy helps him with. It doesn't follow that this person has to become indigent or has to do without the common necessities of life. He may live within a reasonably comfortable, happy, prosperous pattern as long as possession does not dominate him. The moment possession comes first and integrity is compromised, the mental coordinator can bring in a whole pattern of difficulties that are going to follow. That is, if the person is looking or listening. If he is not, then the coordinator will probably bring in a series of excuses so that he can continue to make the same mistakes. It's a very tricky thing, this mind, and we have to work with it with a great deal of integrity. Perhaps it is the first thing we have to convert to religion. Now, most people believe that the body should be converted by baptism, but something has to convert the mind. The mind has to be brought back to a high moral code. It must be disciplined into repentance for its own foolishness. It must be under the guidance of someone or something stronger than itself, that is honorable in every sense of the word, and also skilled in the use of the instrument. Thus we have the computer. The computer can do anything within a mechanical pattern, but it is useless, worthless, and vain if there isn't a human being operating it. Now, we have to find in the confusion of life where the human being in ourselves is located and what power it has to determine our conduct. If we do not make this decision and this discovery, we will simply be in trouble for the rest of our lives. So behind the mind and beyond it, there must be the operator. There must be that power which is essentially the true value of life. Well, various mystics and philosophers and esotericists and metaphysicians of countless branches have taken this problem into serious consideration. And in the stream of Western mysticism particularly, the final version has been that the heart is the leader over the mind. The good heart can control the mind because it puts pressure upon value. Love is stronger than hate. Hate is a mental factor. Love is a spiritual one. The moment our hates increase, it's because the machine is grinding out all kinds of testimonies of what we have suffered. What other people have done to us, especially some one or two persons whom we will never be able to forget. The reason we will not be able to forget is because the mind continues to play the tune every day. The only answer to this, then, is to get an operator that can cancel out the influence of the mind or reduce it as far as possible. And this operator, which is in man, the center of his own life, is the heart. The heart, therefore, is not an organ that receives all kinds of messages. It does, however, have the peculiar power which the mind does not have. The mind has to gather from the outside. The heart has to release from the inside. That which comes from the heart seems to come from the source of life. That which comes through the mind seems to come from the source of trouble. And the two points of view are only reconcilable by a dedication or an interpretation of mystical experience. Actually, therefore, we may say that if the heart leads, the mind can be converted. The mind can gradually come to censoring its own attitudes. It can say that for 20 years this data has been fed in, that we don't like somebody. Now, by a moment of spiritual realization, we have forgiven them. Now, at that moment, love, or the soul, has taken precedence over the mind. And when this occurs, the mind has to accept, because the mind is lesser. The mind has to realize that if it wasn't for the heart, there wouldn't be any mind, any more than there would be any physical brain, unless the heart was constantly pumping life. So the leadership of the heart over the mind is something that we still have to learn in this world. For the heart is that which gives us the moral instruction and the ethical integrities necessary to use the mind constructively. Of course, most of the mystics have also discovered gradually that the need for the power of the intellect decreases to the measure that man's inner life unfolds and enlightens. The mind is not necessarily going to be a tempter forever. The mind can be of itself circumscribed. It can be included within something bigger than itself. The moment the heart leads the mind, then the mind begins to see good in the testimonies of the sensory perceptions. And instead of the sensory perception coming in and saying, I'm going to have alcoholic refreshments today, the heart says, no, not today, and the mind accepts it. It is necessary for the heart, however, to lead. And the problem, of course, is what way should the heart lead? Well, the heart has to lead a much more difficult pattern than the mind. The mind depends entirely upon physical things. It depends upon the observatories, the laboratories, all the research work that is being done in every field. It requires a long and specialized education in an art or a science by which proficiency is attained. But there is no art or science that we gain, no tremendous discovery that we make that transcends the inevitable dissolution of ourselves. In other words, whatever we have to leave behind. Whatever information we have accumulated is going to be subject to renovation and reformation. Already the Einstein theory is assailed on every hand. What we consider to be the great discovery of the moment is left behind and forgotten when new facts are discovered. So all this vast accumulation of material factors has very little essential enduring value. And in the process of getting there, the individual has allowed the better part of himself to become corrupted and corroded. In the search for fame, in the search for wealth, in the desperate desire for public office, the individual betrays the heart and depends upon the schemes of the mind to fulfill his purposes. All these purposes are short-lived, and in a very short time, the mental coordinator and its activities cease to be of value or significance. On the other hand, the heart seems to have a different kind of life. The heart, because it is directly connected with the source of physical life, has within itself a certain germ of immortality. It has the seed of spiritual integrities as part of its own existence. It is the most tenacious thing in the world of forms. It is a tremendously vital something, living upon a force and a power which no scientist has ever been able to discover. Because all of life is invisible, and that which is invisible cannot be discussed adequately in visible terms. And certainly the invisible cannot be well recorded upon a computer, because these things depend upon visual factors. They depend upon a series of mechanical processes. And behind all mechanical processes in life is a process that is transmechanical, above it, far, far beyond it. So the heart becoming, as we might say, the source of reality, begins to search for what we are all searching for in this world, and that is happiness. We would all like to be happy. But of course, as the Oriental mystic would say, in order to be happy, you must be right. There's no amount of wrong that can actually lead to an enduring happiness. Fulfillment of some selfish project brings a moment of thrill or excitement. But in a short time, the circumstances close in and the individual finds himself in trouble. So the problem always is to find out how we can do things without violating the laws of existence. How we can transcend personal desire. Now, of course, most people find they can sacrifice their own personal happiness for some other cause. There are quite a few people that feel that way, and some do it. But for the majority, to go against the appetites of physical existence is a great hardship, a hardship that very few are interested in facing. To further complicate this point of view also, is the end of life is itself invisible. After we depart from this mortal coil, the physical factors cease, the computer has to stop because there is nothing more that it can register. But to many people, this mystery of what lies beyond is so abstract that the mind turns naturally to the addiction to things visible in this world. Therefore, we sacrifice the invisible unknown for the fulfillment of visible known appetites and ambitions. There seems to be very little way of getting around this unless we again begin to develop the power of the heart and begin to see what it can do to make these things work better. Looking around the world as it is today and as it has always been, we cannot but realize that there is something wrong. And that something is wrong is the lack of natural affection. Nations do not like each other. Individuals live in a world of pressures and competitions. Country after country exploits other countries and invades them. War is in the air, even while peace is being discussed. Everything in the physical world is in uproar. It is in an uproar due to the fact that just honest kindness has been lost. Now, the Buddhist philosophy goes in on this in the introduction of the Lord Maitreya. The Lord Maitreya is believed in Buddhist philosophy to be the next great avatar, the one who is to follow Gautama. And the great avatar, Maitreya, is in the Tushita heaven waiting to come down into mortality. This is the Prince of Peace. The word Maitreya simply means kindness. The word actually means that. Therefore, the idea of the personal deity is not the important circumstance. The only answer to the problems of life is kindness. When individuals are kindly and thoughtful, then the mind is used to support thoughtfulness. And every factor that comes along is interpreted in the terms of how we can be more friendly, more kindly, more compassionate. This idea that the Prince of Peace, the one to come, the desired of all nations, is kindness, is not an abstraction. It is obviously the only answer, apart from dissolution. But the individual will accept this answer. But he doesn't know what to do about it, and he doesn't know how he can hope that it will arise in this sorrow-torn globe on which we live. But the fact of the thing remains that the kindness factor is enthroned in the heart. And outside of kindness itself, there is really no solution to problems. Now, kindness can be exploited. Unkind people can turn upon a kindly one and make life very difficult. But the person who is basically kindly cannot actually be hurt by unkindness. We are hurt by unkindness because we are offended by it, because we believe it is unjust, because we sense that it is ulterior in its motivations. But in this process, we lose the kindness factor ourselves, and then the problem is really bad. So regardless of what others do to us, the wise person is kind and moderate at all times, searching forever to find the good and determined to build upon it. If he does this and turns his attention to society, he may be surprised on how much goodness he's going to find there. This is not the type of thing that we hear about. It's not the thing that makes the newspapers or the television programs. The good things people do are for some reason taken for granted. The bad things are dramatized. This seems to be the way of pointing out something. But most people do not get that kind of a reaction from it. They assume the rest of the world is like the individual who is delinquent on a television screen. So we go on down to what else can we do about some of these points, and we go back to the mental coordinator again. The mental coordinator, for example, is probably educated essentially by only one thing, and that is experience. The mental coordinator must derive its basic information from the things around it, because it can only depend upon the sensory perceptions for evidence. Therefore, if it is unprejudiced, open, kindly, and basic attitudes, it can and will gain a great deal from the contemplation of environment. If it is cruel and unkind and selfish and self-centered and arrogant, it will still learn a great deal from the conditions around it, because it will ultimately see all these things fail, and those who are participating in them come to grief. But the individual who is not honest is not looking for these integrities. He is denying them and clinging desperately to the iniquities. Actually, therefore, the experience factor is important to the mental coordinator. The five sensory perceptions are brought together under a sixth collective unit, which is called the coordinator. In this, all these things are mixed together to form perhaps a brew like the witches of Macbeth brewed in their iron pot. But also, out of all this conflict, there comes an ordering factor. We have a series of faculties in the brain to which these various pressures are assigned and by which the various elements of character are built up. Wherever something good is found, it strengthens the faculty of that character. Therefore, if we find a generous person, a certain part of ourselves is given a lesson in generosity, and it will stay if the individual is mindful to keep it alive. If, however, generosity is regarded as a vice, then it will be forgotten as quickly as possible. But remembered or forgotten, the action will have its own honorable or dishonorable fulfillment. There is no way of escaping it. So finally, as the Zen points out, if you really want to know what the rules are, you can sit under a tree like Lao Tse did in China, on the plantation or on the estates of a great noble.